profiles of artists and celebrities in the New Yorker. He's written a new book called Off the Wall, and it's a biography of artist Robert Rauschenberg, but through telling Rauschenberg's story, Tompkins has described the art scene in America from the late 40s through the 70s. The book, again, is called Off the Wall, The Art World of Our Time. Welcome to Fresh Air. Do you feel like Robert Rauschenberg's life embodies certain larger issues for the arts today?
I do. Yes, that was certainly one of the reasons why I chose him to be the focus of this book. I wanted to write a book that would say something about what had happened not only in the art world but also in America in the last 20 years. And he seemed to me somebody who really embodied a lot of it in a very lively way. I think a lot of the things that happened in the 60s, a lot of the breaking loose and the overthrowing of authority and the finding of new paths and the trying of new things is prefaced in a way in Rauschenberg's whole career. His openness to new experience, his being willing to include in art all sorts of things that hadn't been included before, I think is very characteristic of that period.
What are some of the influences that you feel his work has had on other artists?
Well, of course, influences are always a little bit tricky because artists are influenced by everything, by what they eat and what they see, and by what's happened 100 years ago as well as what's happened 20 years ago. A lot of the things that Rauschenberg did that have been influential were done a lot earlier. For instance, in the period after the First World War, there were the Dadaists who began using all kinds of ridiculous materials in art, like bus tickets and bits of detritus that they'd pick up in the street, and so when Rauschenberg began using Con Ed lumber and things he'd pick up on the streets of New York, when he began using them as collage materials, a lot of people said, "Ah, Dada, it's just the old Dada movement over again." But of course, in Rauschenberg's case, it was different because his attitude was different. The Dadaists had been primarily against things. They were disgusted and horrified by the stupidity of the war, and almost everything that they did was in some sense a protest. Whereas Rauschenberg wasn't protesting anything; he was accepting the world as it was, and the world that he happened to be inhabiting at the moment was the downtown Lower East Side in New York, and the things he used in his paintings and collages with the things that he saw all around him.
You say that nowadays artists who years ago might have dreamed of coming to New York and starving in a garret now think of coming to New York hoping to make it and become a celebrity artist, and maybe Rauschenberg is a good example of that type of celebrity artist, someone who's made it and who's been in the pages of the glossy magazines. Do you feel like he's one of the first in that new kind of artist celebrity that we see now?
Yeah, he certainly is that. And a lot of artists have actually told me that. A lot of younger artists have said that in itself was a big influence to them. Reading about Rauschenberg kind of made them think, "Wow, that's maybe something I can do too. If he can do it, I can do it." It was such a break with the old idea of the artist as being a mystical, sort of a hierarchical personage. It was that the artist can be anybody, and it certainly was at a time that art was beginning to be talked about as news, of which had happened before Rauschenberg. In the generation before him, in the Jackson Pollock generation, for the first time you began to have feature articles in magazines like Life and like Newsweek, articles about contemporary art. And this had never happened really before in this country, that mass circulation magazines had really taken any notice of what was going on in the visual arts. And at first, the articles were purely scornful, that they referred to Jack the Dripper, and they sort of took the position that it was a hoax, and it was a good laugh. But it was in 1947, there was a very influential long article in Life magazine, which was a round table on contemporary art, and a number of authorities, who were a couple of critics, and Francis Taylor was the director of the Metropolitan Museum, and several other people, sat around a table and talked about contemporary art, and most of them talked in a very derogatory way. But a couple of them had some interesting things to say about people like Jackson Pollock, such as that, well, maybe what he was doing was important, and although it was upsetting to look at and difficult, that maybe we should remember that almost all new art is difficult to look at first. And this was really a beginning, and about a year after that, Life ran a feature article on Pollock, which was a sort of hedging article. It's a Jackson Pollock. Is he the most important painter in the United States? Question mark. And then it talked about him, but the question mark was still there at the end. I mean, the impression was that you could decide that he was important or that he was a hoax, but the magazine was not saying. But still, the very fact that he was given several pages, a color spread in Life, was enormously significant, and it was significant to him because his prices began going up, and he began selling some pictures.
Yeah, no, prices have gotten so high, like Pollock's, since his death, have gone for enormous sums of money. And I wonder what effect the money that's involved with some contemporary art has had on the way the arts are covered now by glossy magazines, since the arts have become so tied with what we might call jet set lifestyle and a certain sense of partying and high glamour life in New York.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is certainly one of the reasons that that art now has become such a kind of a mass interest, because money has come into it. And it really didn't happen until the end of the 50s, and but as soon as it happened, it changed the whole picture, and of course the artists who had made their reputations before then are often convinced that everything that's happened since then is totally corrupt. Because here are young artists making a lot of money when they didn't make anything at all until they were in their 60s, maybe.
Well, what did the effect of money and celebrity status have on Rauschenberg?
It's something that interested me a lot. I had started a New Yorker profile of Rauschenberg in 63, and I'd been spending a lot of time with him in his studio, which was then on 12th Street and Broadway, and at that time he was pretty well known within the art world. He was influential, but he was certainly not looked upon as an important artist outside of the art world. He was still the sort of the enfant terrible, and people thought he went too far. Everything he did was sort of too much, and I began writing about him at that particular period. And he wasn't really, he was by no means rich. He was his pictures were selling for mostly less than $1,000. And in '64, which I still hadn't hadn't finished the article. In 64, he was chosen as one of the American artists to represent this country at the Biennale in Venice. And he won. He was awarded the major international prize for painting at the Biennale, which was the first time this had ever happened to any American artist. There had been a couple of prizes to American artists. The sculpture prize had gone to Calder once, and much earlier there had been a less important prize had gone to Whistler. But no American artist had ever won the sort of major international prize for painting. And so, of course, when Rauschenberg won this, it was obvious to him and everybody else that this was a major event. And the European press treated it as a major and sort of scandalous event. And on the day after the award was made, there was a victory party for Bob Rauschenberg, given by his dealer Leo Castelli, and there were about 40 people. We went out in boats to an island and had a wonderful long lunch at an Italian trattoria. And at the end of it, I was walking down back to the boats with Rauschenberg after we'd all had a lot of wine and we're feeling very good. And all of a sudden he began a talk. Bob is enormously open about everything. Everything sort of is on the surface with Bob. And he began talking about his anxieties about what this would do to him, because he knew that everything was now going to be different. That in the first place that everybody was going to be looking at him. Attention was going to be fixed on what he did next. Would it be an advance or would it be a retreat? In other words, he lost his freedom, and he was very worried about it. And he talked in what to me was a very moving way about his fear of losing contact with himself, because he said, you know, for me, it's all I've got. It's the only thing I've got, and he was quite nervous about or what would happen with this sort of sudden fame. And actually what he did was he stopped painting for about 3 years. He came back and he became involved with a movement for art and technology to help artists get involved with engineers to use new materials. He got involved with the dance, with modern dance movements, modern theater movements, and he really he didn't paint for about 3 years.
It's interesting. You can see Rauschenberg, I guess, as having developed his style from abstract expressionism, or having picked up in a way where they left off. It interests me that there is such a thing as movements within the art, where you can identify a bunch of painters and call them abstract expressionists, or you can identify a bunch of painters and call them minimalists. And I wonder what you think it is that forms movements like that in the first place, if you see people as individuals reacting individually to similar things in their environment, or maybe being influenced very deeply by one another so that their styles become similar.
Oh, it's funny, yeah. It's very often the case that the artists who are part of a movement are never aware of being part of a movement,
or don't want to be identified that way. It's sometimes the worst thing that you could say to someone is, "Gee, you are part of the whatever movement," and no one wants to be categorized, really.
And it's true with the abstract expressionists, who were very a very different group of painters. I mean, there are some like Pollock and de Kooning who were very sort of emotional and gestural and are primarily romantic painters, and there are others like Newman and Still and Rothko who are much more controlled and intellectual, but they all sort of knew each other, and they all had a common experience, which was that they all had a radical change of style in mid-career. I had sometime in their 40s, are mostly in their mid-40s, and they've been painting in certain fairly recognizable realistic styles. And then as a result of certain common experiences, one of the most important of which was contact with the European surrealist painters who came here during the Second World War, that each one, one after another, within a very few years, had a kind of a major breakthrough into a totally different style. And the styles were not the same that they came through into, but the experience of breaking through, of sort of that enormous change of life, was something that happened to all of them. So they felt as though they'd been through something together. It was like going through the war.
It seems that in contemporary art, people seem to either be trying very hard for a certain very deep self-expression or transcendent statement, or reacting against that and going for a very abstract philosophy or just a purely color or structural formal statement, one that isn't involved with the deep singular emotions that mm-hmm. someone is feeling. And I sometimes get the feeling that it's this constant swing of the pendulum back and forth between self-expression and a more abstract, objective philosophy. And I wonder if you see contemporary art as always reacting that way to what's come before.
Well, I think not just contemporary art. I think this has happened all through the history of art. But like everything else in our century, it's speeded up enormously. So that what might have taken 50 years in the 17th century would take maybe 10 years now, but certainly pop art was a reaction against the romantic sort of emotional expressionism of Jackson Pollock and his colleagues. It was an almost a sort of a deliberate attempt on the part of people, none of whom knew what the others were doing, to say, well, I have enough of this looking into my own soul. I'm going to look out and see what's going on around me. And this is what they did. And I think that's what's the interesting thing about pop art is that for the first time in quite a long time, American artists actually took a look at the visual landscape that everybody sees. And it was not a critical look or a satiric look or a loving look or any other kind of look. It was just an objective kind of look, and they looked at the billboards and the highways and the urban landscape, and they put down what they saw, more or less.
Now, for a lot of the viewing public, it was a very confusing look, because what's the difference between a soup can in the supermarket and one that's painted by Andy Warhol, or what's the difference between a beer can in the supermarket and one that's created by Jasper Johns? How do you tell the difference, and why is one valuable and one not, and why is one in a museum and one on your kitchen table? And are you being fooled by the whole thing? Is it just one big trick? How do you think that whole idea of the hoax of contemporary art has has sat with you? Because there has been this feeling like, gee, are they trying to pull the wool over my eyes?
Oh, sure. I know people have felt this. And, but, you know, people felt that about Picasso. And some people still feel that about Picasso. I've heard this said in terms of the current Picasso show at the Modern Museum in New York. People said, well, all this excitement about Picasso, He still isn't my idea of what an artist is. You know, there are people who still reject him. And 20 years ago, it was the majority. People thought that he was just purely arbitrarily an ugly painter. That he was distorting reality for no purpose whatsoever. And it's pretty much the same kind of reaction that people had to the Impressionists in their time. And I think it's a normal, inevitable reaction to anything that's a new departure in art. If an artist or a group of artists begin to look at a different sort of subject matter or to paint the old subject matter in a completely different way, it's going to upset people and it's going to bother them, and they're going to think it's a hoax, or that somebody is trying to, because it's very hard to have your visual expectations violently changed.
It's interesting that someone like Warhol, who worked with the popular vocabulary, billboard imagery, magazine imagery, ended up being part of that popular vocabulary through getting cover spreads on magazines and having a lot of feature articles written about him, and creating a fast food restaurant for a while. I mean, his life has really started operating within that whole vernacular of popular culture. I wonder how other artists have reacted to him, artists who you know, and reacted to his popularity and status and celebrity.
I don't know. Warhol is sort of a mystery to me. He's become a sort of a sacred cow. He was a lot of artists, of contemporary artists, will never say anything bad about him, because he's so. I don't know why. I think he's, of my own opinion, is that he's he's a very minor and rather uninteresting artist. And this is perhaps my own blindness, that I can't really see what a lot of other artists see as his importance. But to me, Warhol comes out of a very superficial and meretricious approach. He began as a fashion artist, and he was interested primarily in making money, which he did as a fashion artist. He became one of the most highly paid in New York, and then he began to think it'd be nice, because contemporary art was becoming sort of more important than fashion. He began to think it would be nice to be an art artist, and he's been remarkably successful. I suppose there is no artist in the world who's established his name more indelibly than Warhol, but I just I get nothing back from it myself. So I
see him as being a con man at all.
Yeah, and I see him as making no bones about that. As
it's become part of his art, hasn't it?
Yeah,
I just want to say, if you're just joining us, that my guest is Calvin Tompkins, who writes for The New Yorker. He's done many profiles of artists, and his new book is called Off the Wall, The Art World of Our Time, and it's basically a biography of Robert Rauschenberg, but in discussing Rauschenberg, he discusses many aspects of the arts in America from the 1940s on up. And talking about different styles and different reactions to discipline and self-expression and philosophical statements, there's an interesting aspect of what you write about that I'd like to refer to here, and that's the time when Rauschenberg decided that what he needed was some more discipline, and therefore he would try to study with Joseph Albers, who was a painter known for a very disciplined approach. His paintings, he did a long series of paintings of basically squares within squares, one color square within another color square, and it's the opposite of self-expression. There's like no room for self-expression was irrelevant in his paintings. What happened when those two personalities came together? Did it work at all for Rauschenberg?
Well, Rauschenberg says that Albers was his most important teacher. And Albers, who's dead now, he was often asked what he had thought about Rauschenberg as a student, and he would never admit that he remembered him. He said, I had a lot of students, I can't be expected to remember them. But people who were at Black Mountain College at the time all seemed to agree that Albers detested him and thought he was the worst student he'd ever had. And Rauschenberg himself says he was the worst student that Albers ever had. But Rauschenberg knew that he needed a disciplinary a factor in his work. And he quite deliberately came to work with Albers because he had heard that Albers was the greatest disciplinarian in art teaching. And he tried very hard to... he wasn't a bad boy at Black Mountain. He did everything... he did every assignment conscientiously. He did everything he could to do what Albers wanted. And I think in a way that Rauschenberg has always has known just what he needs and has made use of it. I think he did learn a lot from Albers. He learned a great deal about color and the interrelationship between color, which he was then able to ignore. But because he knew about it, he could ignore it with impunity. He could then do what he wanted. And the thing that people forget about Rauschenberg, I mean, everybody emphasizes Rauschenberg's indiscipline, his messiness of his work, but it's also exquisitely balanced. There's a balance of elements in everything that Rauschenberg does that makes it absolutely characteristic. You'd never mistake it for the work of anybody else. And I think a lot of this is internalized discipline.
Albers, I think, told him that if you think one color is better than another color, you're thinking incorrectly, because all colors are interesting and useful in and of themselves. And I think he tried to get away from making value judgments on colors. And you describe a period where Rauschenberg just couldn't come to terms with what color he'd want to use for what purpose. It became difficult to decide between colors. And I wonder if that's become, or if that had become symptomatic of a lot of artists who became exposed to this new sense of values in form and in color, because it perhaps does become difficult when you lose certain values and try to get out of them to then make decisions.
Well, yeah, I think here again, this is another case where Rauschenberg is very characteristic of a lot of attitudes that became prominent in the 60s, that Rauschenberg did not want to use green to intensify yellow. He wanted each color to be to sort of speak freely for itself. He said he just wanted to get them to be as good as they were in the tube, and that in a sense is saying, I don't want to exercise controlling authority over anything, over colors or shapes or lines or anything else. I don't want to be an authority. I mistrust the whole concept of authority and control and telling people what to do. And this, in a way, is a lot of what happened in the 60s, that a lot of people who were younger than Rauschenberg began to question the whole value of central authority, of somebody telling somebody else that this is how you ought to think and be and act.
There were a number of, still are many artists who have a very definite philosophy within their art, but it's interesting sometimes when their way of acting as people is in conflict in some way with that philosophy of art. And I think here of John Cage, who you discuss, who was very much involved with indeterminate processes and chance, flipping coins or maybe using computers to decide what note or what word to use next in a piece. But you say that in life he was actually, or is actually, quite formal, particularly compared to someone like Rauschenberg.
Well, John Cage himself has said that at Rauschenberg embodies in his life the kind of attitudes that Cage has tried to work with in his music, and has expressed a kind of an envy of Rauschenberg's ability to be as free as he, Cage, would like to be. But of course, the other side of that is that that Rauschenberg's lack of discipline has led to a great deal of waste and hard drinking and not so good art and all these other things.
You talk about a time when Cage got really angry at Rauschenberg, who they were working together along with Merce Cunningham, and Rauschenberg didn't seem to be at the theater at the time the show was supposed to start, and Cage gave him a long lecture about how one couldn't be frivolous about time in the context of theater.
Yeah.
Whereas again, in his art, Cage might have been talking about indeterminate processes, which is a very different approach to discipline.
That's right. And and the actual specific result of that argument, which was a very upsetting to Rauschenberg, was that he made a painting that incorporated a clock. He got his first time painting. It was a big electric kitchen clock that becomes a collage element in the painting.
We're talking a little bit about how philosophy and the way you live your life and the way you do your art relate to one another. And I think here of conceptual art, in which the philosophy became the art itself. What do you see as being like the seeds of conceptual art, which I guess in some ways dominated part of the art scene of the 1970s?
Yeah, from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, it was the dominant conceptual and minimal. And I think this had the real seeds of conceptual art come from Duchamp, from Marcel Duchamp, who is probably the most important single influence on all of these artists we're talking about. And whereas Picasso was the most important influence on the artists of the Jackson Pollock generation, and they had a very hard time sort of breaking away from him. His influence was so powerful for all the artists who have come after. Not all, but for a great many of the artists who have come after, the important figure, the sort of the key influence has been Marcel Duchamp, and it was Duchamp whose controlling idea was that the important thing about art is that art is a mental act. That what you do with your hand, that the facility of with paint and palette knives and all of that facility of the hand is of minor importance. That what really accounts is what happens in the artist's mind, is the conception of what he's going to do, and you can sort of see this evolving through people like Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, the idea that you can use all of these different things in a work of art, in a painting or a sculpture or a collage, that you can try anything, that you keep on trying all these different things. And in which you're really asking the question, what is art? What is a work of art? And it's an intellectual question, and you keep on sort of testing it with various objects and various constructions, and then you come and what you're doing, in a sense, is reducing the means of art. You are saying that art is not manual skill, that art is a, as Leonardo da Vinci called it, a cosa mentale. It's a thing of the mind, and you see more and more emphasis coming into to what you decide to paint, and less into how you paint it, and the end, a product of that, I would think, is the conceptual artwork in which there is no object at all. There is an idea. An artist has had an idea, and he writes a paragraph maybe on a typewriter, and hangs it on a wall. But he's saying, I don't have to make an object. There are already too many objects in the world. I don't have to make an object. It's my idea that's the important thing. And this is what a lot of artists did.
You know, I always wondered if it would get to the point where people would say, Christ, there's already too many ideas in this world. I think I'll make an object. Because
yeah, well, I think this has happened now. But I think but from my own opinion is that too many of the ideas were of no interest whatsoever. That the ideas were so trivial and so sort of self-referential and egotistical and boring that the movement just sort of disappeared into thin air. And there has been a reaction of of perhaps an inevitable kind of a lot of younger artists who are coming back now to frankly decorative painting. You know, for years we've been saying that decoration is a term of disapproval. That if art looks decorative, it can't be any good. And now there are all sorts of artists who are making very frankly sort of a decorative works of art. They're influenced by Islamic textiles and tiles and by all sorts of purely decorative motifs, and this in a way is a very obvious antithesis to the idea that it's only the idea that counts.
Do you think that the conceptual art movement has in fact vanished in thin air? Do you see very little remnants of it at this point?
Well, yes, there are all sorts of remnants of it all around. There's a lot of conceptual arts still being made. I think more in Europe than here. I think it really has sort of run down and played itself out here. But in Europe, you have an artist like the German Joseph Beuys, who's primarily interested in working on people's minds politically. And in doing things, what he does actually is not quite conceptual, because it's more like a form of theater. He does public performances and spectacles that whose purpose really is to make people think.
What do you think is going to survive from the conceptual art movement? What I mean by that is, like, pieces or artists that you think are going to really withstand time and remain very important.
I can't think of any. Of course, a lot of things have been called conceptual that are not. Some of the earthworks out in Nevada that Michael Heiser, for instance, has done have been called conceptual, because it's because the main thing was the idea of moving 22,000 cubic tons of earth from one place to another or something. But what you have is an enormous sort of visual a thing out there. It isn't just a concept. It's it exists, or it exists temporarily at least. But I can't think of any purely conceptual work that's going to have any staying power whatsoever.
It's ironic that when you were talking about Duchamp as being the single most important influence on the conceptual art movement, and everyone thought that during the last years of his life he wasn't really making art, and he was making puns about it maybe and talking about it and playing a lot of chess, but in fact he was creating a very major work that is now in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And since we all have visual access to this piece, it's in the heart of our city, I'd really be interested in hearing your description of and I guess analysis of the Etant Donné.
Yeah, well, that is that's the most marvelous irony of Duchamp's enormously ironic and wonderful life, that all of these years, as you say, when people thought he had abandoned art, he was working in secret on this astonishing piece. And it certainly is not a conceptual piece, although it's enormously it is a concept. I mean, you can see it. Only one person at a time can look at it. You go into this room and look through two peepholes in a wooden door, and you see this tableau, this astonishing tableau. I don't know as it can be described. It's almost the opposite of everything else that Duchamp had ever done. It's instead of being abstract, it's glaringly realistic. You have a nude woman splayed in front of you on a bed of real twigs, and the woman looks real. Her skin is made of pig skin, And in the background is a very realistic painted landscape with a trompe l'oeil waterfall, and the light looks extraordinary lighting. It looks like with the light that you get about 4 o'clock in an October afternoon when the sun is just sort of going down, and there's a very sort of a brilliant but very yellow kind of golden light, and it's a terrible shock. I mean, there she is, and there's this enormously realistic landscape which looks like calendar art in a sense, but then there's so many mysterious things that are happening. It's a very mysterious scene, and it certainly leads one furiously to think, and I'm sure nobody thinks the same things when they look at it. It can't be photographed. There's no way of even reproducing it. So when you see it, you are seeing it for the first time.
Do you feel like it makes a statement about, because you talked about Duchamp as being someone who saw art as being about the purpose of art. And if we look at the piece in those terms, is there a statement that it makes to you?
Well, no, I don't really think it makes a statement of any specific kind. I think it certainly deals with themes that appear in everything else in every other major piece of Duchamp's. There's there is the nude woman, which is constant throughout his work. There is the gas lamp, which she is holding up in her hand, which means something from his childhood. There is the waterfall. There is the sense of nature, but a rather desiccated a sort of nature seen through 20th century eyes. There's irony, there's bitterness, there's eroticism. There are all of these things that have been in Duchamp's work. And like every other major work of art, and I think it is a major work of art, it's essentially mysterious. We don't really know what it is there that is going on, but a lot is going on.
Were a lot of people insulted that after they thought that Duchamp wasn't working, that he in fact was working on a very detailed piece and devoting years and years of his life to it?
Well, yes, a lot of people. His biographer, Arturo Schwartz, who was a man, an Italian, who had devoted at least 20 years of his life to intensive studies of Duchamp, and who was writing an enormous book whose title is The Complete Works of Marcel Duchamp, had not heard about this. And at the very last minute, after Duchamp had died and the book was about to go to press, the news was revealing, he had to hold up the book and quickly insert a couple of pages on this. On this last work. But it's, you know, a lot of people were amazed, but it was so characteristic of Duchamp, because he never did reveal much, and there were always surprises.
Have you gotten the feeling that during part of the 70s, a lot of the art that was being made was being addressed to other artists, because it depended so much on knowing a lot about other works of art and about getting references and getting maybe puns that were relating to other pieces of art as well, and coming with a lot of background and detail to it in order to get anything out of it. I'm referring to some conceptual art here.
Yeah, that's true, but I'm not sure that it hasn't always been true. I think an awful lot of art has always been about other art. I think a lot of 17th century Italian painting was about 16th century Italian painting. They're always the primary subject matter of art has always been art, really, more than nature. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that it was more sort of consciously so in recent years that instead of a lot of artists have looked purely at other art, and I think this is partly a result of the fact that art education has become so widespread in this country. And after the Second World War, when all the GIs were going back to school, and the colleges had to expand so enormously to accommodate them, about the largest growing departments in most colleges were art departments, because an awful lot of GIs wanted to do something in the arts, and this has increased steadily since then. So you have more and more people coming out of school who have spent, say, 2 years of graduate school studying history of art. Now, this was, of course, this was certainly not the case with the Jackson Pollock generation. Pollock and those people had some formal training in art, but by and large, they had not been through 4 years of college and then had graduate studies in art, which you find more and more is the case with young artists.
What do you use when you're seeing art for the first time? Do you expect to have a visceral reaction to a piece, or is it a more intellectual thing that frequently gets wrong when you're seeing something that you think has great value?
Well, I've always wondered. I've never been quite sure. I don't think of myself as a critic. I've always been basically a reporter about art and artists, and I know I must respond sort of more readily to certain things than to others. I have always responded more readily to Rauschenberg than to Ellsworth Kelly, for instance, and so there must be some sort of a visceral reaction. I think that I like that. That my own prejudices are always asserting themselves. I like a kind of art that seems to come down off the wall. I think that's partly why I use that title. This was one of the things that I liked about so much of the art of the 50s and the 60s, that art was becoming something else. That it had been up there on the walls of museums and the living rooms of the rich, and it had been very far away and isolated and aloof, and then in the work of Rauschenberg particularly and a lot of others, it sort of became much more approachable. It came down off the wall in a way into the street and became a much sort of closer to us. I can remember my first time I ever saw a picture by Rauschenberg. It was a small collage painting in the a show of 15 Americans at the Modern Museum, and there was it included as a collage element a torn-off piece of a man's shirt with the pockets still on. And I'd never seen anything like this before, and certainly not in a museum. And for some reason, I reached in my pocket and pulled out a nickel and put it in the pocket of the shirt. And it was a contact with a work of art that I'd never had. I mean, I don't recommend this for people to do, but
you gave this a card around.
But it just was a completely different feeling about a work of art.
You also talk about how art has developed a comic sense about itself, that some art began being funny. And when you mentioned that to me before, it actually had never dawned on me before that there was a time when one didn't expect art to have a sense of humor.
Oh no! Art was too much. Was too serious. It was too. It was too much. connected with the church and with the upper classes and with all of that authoritarian sort of idea. It was, if anything, it was for teaching us lessons. But art has, there has been a lot of humor in contemporary art. It has been one of the things. I mean, in pop art, there was a lot of it was really pretty funny. And you could actually sit there and laugh. And this also, I think, made it a difference. It attracted an audience that I think would never have thought of looking at a work of art before.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Calvin Tompkins, and he writes about artists for The New Yorker and has written a new book called Off the Wall, The Art World of Our Time, which is a look at Robert Rauschenberg's life and work, and also a kind of sketch of the art scenes in America from the 40s on up. There's a whole population within the art world who we haven't discussed who are, I think, a pretty powerful lot, and that is the gallery owners, mm-hmm. who I think have a lot of power in determining who gets seen, who gets shown, and the more prestigious a gallery you get shown in, the more press attention you're going to get, and perhaps the wealthier the group of art buyers who come out to see your show are going to be. But in fact, how much power do you think the gallery owners have in determining who becomes successful and who is going to be relegated to obscurity?
Well, they have enormous power. The gallery, the owners, the dealers have in the last 20 years have sort of seized the power from the critics and from the museum people. For a long while, it was the Meyer Museum that had really exercised the life or death power, but the Meyer Museum really sort of made a decision that at a certain point that it wasn't going to be that involved with contemporary art anymore. It was going to be a museum of the art of the first half of the 20th century. Which was never actually specifically said, but it was a tacit sort of understanding, and that left a vacuum, and the people who filled the vacuum were a group of dealers such as Leo Castelli, who has been one of the most influential, Sidney Janis, Andre Emmerich, Sam Coots, people like that who at the beginning. They were very, very nervy. They were taking a big chance on showing the work of people who were not known and who seemed very outlandish.
And now I guess it's not the same kind of chance because they'll help make the reputation of someone who they take a chance on.
Well, that's right. Well, back in the 50s, there were only two or three galleries in New York that dealt in contemporary work, and now there are over 100.
It seems that artists nowadays have to be, I guess, public relations people in a way, since for many artists, doing your work entails writing a good grant proposal, saying the right things to the right people who might be sitting and voting on your grant proposal. I don't know how important it is to do the right things when you're going to meet a gallery owner and try to convince them that they should be showing your work. But do you think that it's more important, more crucial for artists now to have that public relations sense and to be able to market their work to the right people and to be able to describe their work in the right words so that they can get out a good-looking grant proposal?
I don't really know. As far as I know, the way an artist sort of makes it now in New York is through other artists. There's a grapevine, and the artists who are successful in the sense of being represented by one of the better galleries, are constantly bringing to the attention of the dealer, bringing up other artists whom they have met or heard about. Uh, it's it's a curious. Artists are much more generous in that respect than writers. I think most writers, in my experience, would be very happy if no other writer ever published anything. But a lot of artists, in my experience, have been extremely generous. Particularly Rauschenberg. Rauschenberg has been notoriously generous about this, about helping younger artists. And I think most dealers listen quite carefully to their major artists. And if an artist comes to a dealer and says, there's this terrific young artist, you ought to go and look at his work, the dealer will not only do it, but he will be somewhat predisposed to like it. Because dealers are like the rest of us. They're not infallible. And even someone like Astelli at the beginning backed a lot of artists that nobody's ever heard of since. And the dealers they keep their ears open as well as their eyes. And so the most important thing for a young artist is to have the good opinion of other artists.
The gallery owners who you've referred to in the past few minutes are all gallery owners in New York.
Yeah.
Do you think that New York is still the central place for the arts internationally?
It's the central marketplace. I don't think it's any longer so necessary for an artist to be sort of in New York. and a lot of them have moved away. Rauschenberg now lives in an island off the coast of Florida, but it certainly is still the commercial center, and I don't think that there are any galleries outside of New York which have anywhere near the influence or the power of these dozen or so New York galleries that control the scene.
So what patterns do you see emerging now? You mentioned a move towards a more decorative approach, perhaps a more central approach to the arts. Are there any other things that you see on the horizon in contemporary art?
Well, now the big thing that everybody has happened in the 70s was pluralism. The 70s saw the end of the great kind of isms. There's no more dominant style or movement, and everybody went off in different directions and did lots of different kinds of things. I think this is still the case. The decorative state of mind, I'm not sure if that's of any real importance. It seems to be something that a lot of younger artists have fallen into. There's also something that's being loosely called narrative painting, which is sort of semi-abstract, semi-figurative paintings that seem to be telling a story, although very often the story is not too clearly decipherable, but it could be two figures having some sort of an argument or a fight. And there's also a great deal of what seems like deliberately bad painting. People who are reacting against the precision and the delicacy of pure abstract art, and are going out of their way, it seems, to use ungainly shapes and rather unattractive colors to paint badly, not in the sense of naive painting, but a deliberate bad painting. Some of which is quite humorous again.
Kevin Tompkins, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon and for speaking with us and sharing some of your perceptions with us. I've been speaking with Kelvin Tompkins, who writes profiles of artists for The New Yorker, and he's written a new book, and this one's called Off the Wall, The Art World of Our Time, and it focuses on the life and work of Robert Rauschenberg and addresses many of the other issues and describes many of the other artists from about the 1940s through the 70s in America. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Victor Willis, the former lead singer of the Village People, who's now in Philadelphia performing in the show Seasons Reasons. At about 2:45, we'll be hearing from Ellen Berman, who's with the Marriage Council of Philadelphia, and she'll be discussing some of her work as a marriage counselor and some trends that she sees in modern marriages. At 3:30, John Zweig will be with us to review new jazz releases. At 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by James Reed, who's written a social history of birth control, and we'll be talking about the moral climate that has surrounded the history of abortion in the light of the Republican Party stand on abortion. We'll look at this historically. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. Also at 4:30, we'll be talking about the new divorce laws. I hope you can join us then. Our technical director today has been Joyce Lieberman. Contributing today was Charles Hardy. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Listen.